We're going to be talking about cancer research in the U.S., a gigantic money machine. I want to thank Lou Elizondo, Chris Mellon for being here. We change gears now, as I said, and in a moment, we're going to be joined by the author of Cancer Incorporated, a new book by Dr. Ralph Moss, who has spent years investigating the outright outrageous skullduggery and greed in the huge business of cancer drugs, the profits so massive that drug companies have poured piles of dough into the system, and by that I mean the political system, not to cure cancer necessarily, but to sell expensive drugs to the public and to the government, get packed taxpayers to pay for the research while the big pharma companies reap the rewards, which not that much of a concern, according to this book, for the actual cancer patients. I think it's a book that's going to make you want to scream at someone. First, though, I wanted to mention the NAPS news items that we have on the website tonight. Our webmaster, Lex Lonehood, and I have put together our usual assortment of items and oddities. You can find it on the Coast to Coast website. One of the stories about a pretty wild conspiracy story that appears to be legit, how the CIA allegedly planted propaganda via the use of hair metal bands back during the Cold War. Crazy story. Another piece about a Nobel Prize-winning physicist who says he's 99% sure that ESP, psychic abilities, are real. And a think piece about disinformation, not the foreign stuff from Russia or China, but the homegrown variety, domestic disinformation, why it's so prevalent, why it's so dangerous, that and more in NAPS News. And I'm going to say to reassume the position, I would think that the dog and cat are already inside. If they're not, go open up the door and let them in. You probably had three cups of coffee already and plopping yourself down in a comfy spot. That happened a long time ago. And let's face it, you've been wearing your jammies since 3 o'clock this afternoon. That seems to be everybody's uniform these days. We are about ready to rumble with the second half of the program, Cancer Incorporated with Dr. Ralph Moss, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. You know, if you get cancer, your health and the possibility of dying isn't the only challenge that you might face. There's also a good chance you'll go broke, because the drugs that have been developed to fight cancer are so expensive. It's not an accident they cost so much, and it's not an accident that so many new ones come out every year. They are big business for big pharma. Of course, we have 1.7 million new cases of invasive cancer in the U.S. every year, 600,000 deaths, that's about 1,600 every single day. And we're always reading about progress that's made in the fight against cancer. Dr. Ralph Moss is here to tell us that what we read is not always accurate. Dr. Moss, welcome to the program. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
You've been on this for a long time. So in 1980, you wrote your first book about it, and things have not improved since then, I guess.
Well, I mean, the treatment has improved a little bit in some ways, and I'm not saying that no treatments are good or anything like that. Certainly, even chemo, which most people really hate going through, but it has its uses. And so I'll start out by saying something positive. Leukemia, pediatric leukemia, great progress. And it also, chemo can be very effective in preventing recurrences of high-risk cases of breast and colon cancer and so forth. So, you know, I don't want to be dogmatic about it, but by and large, most of the drugs that have been developed in recent years will only increase survival on average by about 3.4 months. So when people hear about, and you hear every day about great breakthroughs being made in cancer, it isn't really true. There have been some breakthroughs made. There have been some great old treatments that are neglected. But by and large, in stage four cancer, which is advanced cancer that has already spread, we're talking about a few months increased survival on average.
You are a cancer survivor yourself, right?
Correct. Yeah, I'm coming up on 5 years of surviving a very aggressive prostate cancer, but I didn't treat it in the normal, typical way. I found a medical center that used cryoablation, which is a relatively benign kind of treatment where they freeze the cancer, actually go in with a little probe and freeze it. And that was an outpatient procedure. if it wasn't for the catheter, I mean, I could have literally, I literally did walk out of the outpatient department and walked to my hotel after that and took a hike the next day. So it was hardly, you know, life-destroying, and the side effects are minimal with that. And then I used a lot of supplements as well after that and changed my diet and so forth. So I think, you know, there are ways to maneuver within this medical system that you don't get to, don't have to get the usual typical destruction of your quality of life, much less your life. But the chemo business is a tremendous business. It's like $100 billion. And it's been manipulated in a way to maximize the profits of about nine big drug companies that control the field.
You know, I think we all have positive feelings about our doctors. You know, you trust your own doctor, even if you don't trust big pharma or big medicine in general. And, you know, you have the impression you want to believe anyway. And I think it's true for most that your doctor goes into that profession, that line of work, in order to help people, to heal people, to help sick people. So it is disconcerting for sure to read the scenario that you paint in Cancer Incorporated about how many doctors, how many medical institutions get into bed with big pharma and how pervasive it is.
Yes. No, I trust my doctors. I don't think I'd be alive today if I hadn't trusted my doctors, and I trust them on a day-to-day basis. But they all have blinders on, and the blinders are because they're, medically speaking, they're created by a system. They function within that system. They're fish swimming in the, you know, in the sea, and they don't really quite realize that there is such a thing as water. And that system is set up and dominated by, as I say, in cancer, by these nine big pharmaceutical companies that basically control the field. And the point of my book, Cancer Incorporated, is to expose how that's done and what impact that control has over the choices that were offered, that the doctors are offered. Nobody wants to deceive their patients, but I know from hundreds of conversations with oncologists and other doctors that most of them are not aware of this information, and it's so devastating that it would be hard for them to go on and continue to serve their patients if they truly grasped and understood what I've laid out in this book, although 95% of my references in the book are to standard medical journal articles. So it isn't. This is hiding in plain sight. If you want to see it, you're going to see it. If you don't want to see it, then you don't have to. Oncologists on average make, I think the average is about $365,000 a year. So, and there are other ways to make money in this field that far dwarf that. So if you, you know, if you're very comfortable in life, you want to continue that comfort. That's just human nature. But what's really going on behind the scenes is that the field has been captured by the drug companies. That's the essence of what's happening here. And because it's been captured in various ways, all the pieces that leading up to approval and sale of new drugs are controlled by the people who profit from those drugs. And so the doctors are basically have been cut out of, the average doctor's been sort of cut out of the equation or made a deal with the devil, let's say. And I do not doubt for 1 minute the vast majority of doctors want to serve their patients. They are professionals. They put the interest of their patients first. But when you look at the government database, which is available, and I give the links in Cancer Incorporated, you see a very disturbing thing, which is that the leaders of the oncology profession, which is the cancer treatment profession, are, by and large, most of them are in the pay of the drug companies. And when I say in the pay, I don't mean just that they get research funding from the drug companies, which is true. I mean that they are getting money in their own pocket for their own personal use from drug companies. And this money, which is disguised under some fancy terms like honoraria, they call it, or speaker's fees, or miscellaneous expenses, This can come to as much as $3 million a year for these, for the top leading doctors, for the decision makers and the influencers within the field. It's not uncommon to see doctors getting $50,000 or $100,000 from drug companies. And again, I must emphasize, this is not, as they might say, well, we need the money in order to do our research. No, no, this is money that's going towards second and third houses, towards putting the kids through, you know, Ivy League college or something like that. It's just personal money coming, flowing from the drug company to the individual.
I had mentioned that you first wrote about this back in 1980, and you know, here it is, 40 years later, and you're writing about it again. But now you've had the experience of being a cancer patient yourself, so you were not motivated to do this by health concerns, at least your own.
No.
What got you into it?
I was hired at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City in 1974 as their science writer, and so I had the ideal job for me. I just got to go around in this amazing, vast, amazing institution and more or less decide who I wanted to, whose work I wanted to write up for our internal magazine, Center News, as well as writing for the annual report and press releases and so forth. And I more or less chose my own topics, which was great. I mean, greatest job I ever had. The problem for me was, within a few months of being hired, I had the great good fortune to interview a man named Kanamatsu Sugiura, who was the oldest, shall we say, tenured faculty member within this Sloan Kettering family. And at the end of the interview, we got around not just to reminiscing about his amazing career, which dated to the first years of the 20th century, but we actually, you know, I asked him about his current work, and he absolutely blew me over by telling me that he was researching Laetrile, which was at that time we were denouncing as a quack treatment for cancer. And I looked at him and I just sort of shook my head and said, well, what is there to research? It doesn't work. And he just said, well, you know, you're wrong about that. And he took down lab notes that he had generated over a period of four years at that point of researching in animals. And he showed me some startling things. One was a shrinkage of tumors, and the other one, much more significantly, was that when he gave Laetrile, or amygdalin, as he called it, to mice with cancer, the control mice, the ones that only got the salt water solution, had about 80 to 90% of them had lung metastases or spread of the breast cancer to the lungs, whereas with the Laetrile-treated animals, somewhere between 10 and 20% of them had lung metastases. And he said, very funny, he said, you know, if I could control it completely, that would be even more impressive. But, you know, controlling about 70 or 80% of the spread of cancer in animals, that had never been seen before. And I'm not sure it's ever been seen since then. So I was astonished, because the statement I was giving out in our public affairs department was exactly the opposite. I mean, it wasn't yet completely negative, but it said we're researching this, but we don't have any evidence that it's going to be effective. And then over the next 3 years, the leaders of our institution just put out one after another increasingly negative statements about Segura's work. And so finally, in 76, Dr. Chester Stock gave an interview. He was one of the vice presidents of Sloan Kettering, and he said, we have found Laetrile negative in all the animal systems we have tested. So this kind of put me over the edge, because it was, of course, it was diametrically opposite of what was really going on. What really was going on was that in our animal experiments, Laetrile had been shown to be effective in three different animal systems. and had been confirmed by others within the institution. And they did such tricks to try to, any way possible, to distort, lie about, and denigrate Dr. Segura, that it just was too much for me. And after I called a press conference to announce these things or denounce these things at the New York Hilton, and they fired me on the following day for, quote-unquote, failing to carry out his most basic job responsibility, so which I took to mean refusing to lie on behalf of your employer, is the ultimate sin within a public affairs department. So, you know, that was the launching of my independent career, 1977. So from 74 to 77, I was an employed, hired gun for the, big pharma controlled institution. And since 77, I've been a freelance person, just basically going around denouncing the corruption within the cancer industry. But as I say, trying to be balanced in the sense of recognizing there is a lot of validity to a lot of the things that doctors and oncologists do. I wouldn't be here myself if it weren't for that fact. But on the other hand, I feel that they have succumbed to corruption at the highest level of the profession by most of them agreeing to take money in pocket from the big drug companies that control the field. And the upshot of this for the average person is that when you go and you try to get these cancer drugs, you're confronted with a horror show, because not only are they very toxic drugs, being essentially very foreign to our basic nature, but the cost of them, as you alluded to, George, is phenomenal. So on average, the new cancer drugs cost $150,000 per patient. If you add a few of those together, it's not uncommon for the cost to run to $1 million per patient. If you give a couple of these drugs together and then you have some side effects and they have to be treated and so forth. So we're looking at costs that are, beyond belief. I mean, within not such a long time ago, the cost of chemotherapy for treating, let's say, colon cancer was about $500. That was a typical bill. If it went to $2,000, that was considered really extraordinary, and people were scratching their heads, how did we get here to the $2,000 mark? Somehow we just blew past all of these restraints, the monetary restraints on cost, and we got to the point where it just seemed normal. $150,000, if you just look at, look at my book, Cancer Incorporated, you'll see the figures there. And that's not at all uncommon. And how well do these drugs work? As I say, we have a very good study showing that on average.
I'll tell you what, Ralph, I'm going to have to interrupt you there. We're going to have to go to a break talking with Ralph Moss about his book, Cancer Incorporated. And yeah, we're going to get into some examples about drugs that were very expensive but do very little. We're talking with Ralph Moss about his book, Cancer Incorporated, the inside story of the corruption, greed, and lies of Big Pharma. Just getting going on some of the examples of drugs that were produced highly expensive, of very dubious value. Some examples when we come back. Ralph Moss, one of the consistent themes, recurring themes that pops up in your book is how the public and the medical community are misled by these. It seems like every other week there's a new breakthrough in cancer research. Oh my gosh, it sounds like it's going to be a cure here. And then, the results are published in some peer-reviewed journal. The research is conducted by seemingly reputable people. Doctors read this stuff and start ordering the drug. Patients see it. They start seeing ads on television and, yeah, I want that stuff. The drugs are very expensive, but the benefits are negligible, and you give a lot of examples. Can you share a couple of them with us where this pattern unfolds?
Sure. I looked at very closely at a drug called Xalkori, X-A-L-K-O-R-I, which was tested at Mass General Hospital, and the reports on the results of this were just fantastic. The very mild side effects, and according to a prominent oncologist, It's relatively non-toxic, a triumph for targeted therapy, far superior to chemo, I'm quoting, and in many cases causes the tumors to melt away with few side effects. This was reported by the AP, the Associated Press, you know, without any critical comment. They set the price on this little red pill at $17,000 a month, or $211,000 a year per patient. And because of that clinical trial, it was quickly approved by the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. Sales boomed, and they're looking at about generating about $1 billion in annual sales, which is not uncommon for these cancer drugs. 6 years later, somebody independent of the company, actually aligned with a different big drug company, did a follow-up study on it. And during that follow-up study, 68% of the patients progressed on the drug, meaning the cancer just continued to grow. And there was central nervous system progression, such as brain metastases, in 45% of the patients. But the most striking thing of all was this dramatically different picture of the drug side effects in that follow-up trial. The original authors had stated that there was just mild grade 1 or 2 GI side effects, but in the new paper, they showed that there was massive amounts of side effects. 97% of the patients had side effects, including very serious side effects, most commonly nausea, diarrhea, vomiting, and some of these, actually 7 of the of patients died. They disguised these deaths by calling them grade 5 side effects. A grade 5 side effect is where you die of the treatment. That was about 5% of the patients. And so why would they originally have said that there was, you know, that it was this mild, groundbreaking drug? Well, here's a couple of interesting facts. First of all, the company that makes the drug, Pfizer, paid for the study at Mass General, and that's a common practice. And the trials earn considerable amount of money for the hospitals. The study was designed by representatives of Pfizer. The data were collected from the academic sites and then analyzed by Pfizer. 2 of the paper's authors were Pfizer employees. 4 were its paid consultants or advisors. 2 owned stock in Pfizer, and 2 more were recipients of research funds and honoraria, which is, as I said, a form of cash payment. But they got this approved through the FDA, where at the key committee, there were several people who were also doing contracted research for Pfizer. And the personal payments for one of the doctors came to $19,000, while her associated research funding was $470,000. And this goes on and on. I mean, look at most of the new cancer drugs. They don't really have any efficacy, most of the new cancer drugs. We could talk about the exceptions to this, and I certainly hope we will, George.
Sure.
But this is more the typical picture. The typical picture is a drug that doesn't really work or works very, very minimally. We don't oftentimes don't even know what the mechanism is by which these drugs are active, and the drug companies are really the puppet masters that are controlling the actions of the top oncologists with cash payments.
By these clinical trials that you discuss in the book, they're dishonest. I mean, to have not only the influence of the drug companies, but the manipulation of the results. Just completely ignoring the side effects, what it does to patients, would seem to be highly unethical.
They're cherry picking. First of all, if you look at clinical trials cherry pick the patients as a rule, which means that they pick only the healthiest and the most financially secure people who could be in the trial, because you have to make sacrifices and to get yourself usually to the cancer center where they're giving that trial and so forth. So you come up with a predominantly white middle class, healthy, young patient population for the clinical trials, most people would not get into a clinical trial. If you have any underlying condition, other underlying health condition, you're not going to get in because they fear that that would bring down their results. So you have this, you know, the paradox of a healthy cancer patient who, other than the cancer, is in really good shape. Of course, the drug is going to perform, probably going to perform better in that patient population. But that's not enough to, just to do that, because the big scam really is in, centers around the word survival. So, you know, they give, like, at the National Cancer Institute dictionary, they give like a dozen definitions of the word survival. For you and me, the word survival is pretty clear, right? It means you live longer on average. If you say you increase the survival of cancer patients, you would think that would mean that on average, cancer patients would live longer, actually have an extension of their life. This isn't usually what's meant by survival in a cancer drug trial. Usually survival means something like disease-free survival. That's a typical thing. Or progression-free survival, meaning that the time that you live without the disease being observed as progressing, it could be progressing in the background, but your instruments haven't yet detected it as progressing, that period can be extended. But the big trick is that very rarely do these drugs actually significantly increase the real survival. So what you want to look for is the phrase overall survival. That's the key. And most times, when you see that the media and the journals are reporting increased survival, they're not talking about anything that actually benefits cancer patients. They're talking about this artificial construct of disease-free survival or progression-free survival. But if you drill down in the data and you try to find out, well, does this drug actually increase, on average, increase the lifespan of the patient with cancer? More times than not, it does not do that. So this is the big scam, because the FDA, since the 90s, the FDA has given accelerated approval to drugs based upon increasing disease-free or progression-free survival. And they know, FDA knows very well, that what matters to cancer patients are three things. One, the drug could cure the cancer. That's extremely rare. Sometimes happens, but it's very rare. Two, the drug could improve or at least maintain good quality of life. That's also rare. It's rarely looked at, actually. The third thing is it would increase the survival, meaning that there would be a meaningful, significant increase in the time that the patient would live. And since they can't prove that, the FDA decided, well, this is just too hard, so let's give them approval based upon increasing the interval of time within which we can't see the disease progressing. And they give approval about 50% of the time based upon that. And then they say, come back later and show us that the drug actually increases the overall survival. Well, the drug companies largely ignore that requirement, and there's no punishment for them if they ignore it. So we have a great number of drugs on the market now that don't actually do anything for the cancer patient, and that's their big trick. They're not lying in the sense that Sloan Kettering was lying about their Laetrile results. It isn't. I'm not focused on that in Cancer Incorporated. I'm focusing on the tricks that are played in order to convince the public that something beneficial is happening when it really isn't.
I don't remember the name of the FDA commissioner that you cite in your book, but you have an example of an FDA commissioner who comes in and tries to fix this, at least in respect to one of these drugs, and calls it out. And
Margaret Hamburg. The only FDA commissioner that I'm aware of who actually tried to take on the drug industry, at least in one case, and they got this drug Avastin to be unapproved for a certain indication because it didn't do anything. It didn't do anything beneficial. It cost a lot of money, and harmed people. If the drug works in in some kinds of cancer, but it wasn't working for breast cancer and especially for brain metastases. So they pulled the drug. It caused such a hullabaloo. You know, she went off and took a different job somewhere else. And then since that time, I can't think of a single instance in which the FDA has, you know, done its job in terms of regulating and restraining the drug industry. They more or less are a captured agency.
It used to be that the FDA had efficacy standards, right? That you had to prove that it works before you get it approved.
Effectiveness. So there's a difference between another trick, semantic trick, is that there's a difference between efficacy and effectiveness. Efficacy is what you get in a clinical trial. It's an artificial construct. Effectiveness is something works in the real world. So a lot of these drugs, you know, they're supposed to do phase four trials in which they show that the drug actually works in the community, but it doesn't. The drugs generally don't work in the community, in the actual medical setting that 95% of people relate to. So they prove efficacy, meaning effectiveness, within the clinical trial, but that's, as I say, a cherry-picked situation. But they can't prove effectiveness, that it actually works once it gets out into the general population.
Let's talk for a couple of minutes. We got about 5 minutes before we go to a break, about the money involved, how big the money is and how it gets spread around.
Yeah. So it's about $100 billion worldwide, and it's concentrated in 9 companies. It used to be 10, but one of them gobbled up, one of the 10 gobbled up the other one. So we're down to 9. About half of those are American companies, like Pfizer, and about half of them are European companies. I think there's one Japanese company in the mix. But basically, it's dominated by the U.S., and the money is about a third would be, about a third would be chemotherapy, about a third would be so-called targeted drugs, and about a third is now immunotherapy. And the immunotherapy drugs, the drug Keytruda, which your listeners may have seen advertisements on television, which is an immunotherapy drug, that generated about, the last figure I saw was $8.8 billion in sales per year. How do they get to that level? I mean, this one drug alone is bigger than the gross domestic product of a lot of countries in the world, you know, smaller countries. It's like a country unto itself. How do they get there? I said you might have seen the ads for this. I don't know whether the listeners realize that there are only 2 countries in the world where it's legal to advertise drugs directly to consumers, and that's the United States and, for some reason, New Zealand. But other than those 2 countries, that practice of advertising drugs to the general public is banned, and banned for a very good reason, because the public, you know, you apply the techniques of modern advertising and mass persuasion, people have no basis on which to be able to evaluate the effectiveness of these drugs or their danger, and the drug companies get away with pretty much anything that they want to do in terms of advertising this. And so people are hyper aware of drugs that are advertised, and this is a proven fact, and they're going to their doctors demanding that their loved ones get these drugs, and the doctors are put under tremendous pressure. Plus, the doctors themselves see these ads, and so they know what's the best sellers and what the world is talking about and so forth, and so they're entranced by this. But the actual way the doctors are supposed to get their information is from objective medical journal articles and articles, you know, about these research reports in their own professional realm. And then if the drug works, then they'll tell the patients about it. And that's the normal way this is done in hundreds of countries around the world. And it's only in the U.S. and, as I say, in a relatively small country off in the Pacific, New Zealand, that you're allowed to actually go directly to the consumer. So it just sets up a kind of a mass demand for these drugs where there is no basis. In fact, it's just that people are desperate. It's understandable that people, you know, want to have a cure. I mean, that's just human nature. That's going to be, as long as cancer is with us, people are going to want to have something that will rescue them and their loved ones. So it's perfectly understandable why the public would react this way. That's why you don't advertise to the general public, because you're taking advantage of people's desperation.
Yeah, it's really pretty sleazy to do that. But I mean, I'm sure that advertising companies are happy to get the business, and the drug companies are happy to use that venue to change people's opinions, put a slick commercial together. Here's the Edsel of cancer medications. Go ahead and buy it, and they don't know any different. We're talking with Ralph Moss about his book, Cancer Incorporated, The Inside Story of the Corruption, Greed, and Lies of Big Pharma. In the next segment, we're going to get into how they corrupt Congress and elected officials and what that means to the lives of cancer patients across the country and around the world. Much more to come here. We'll be opening up the phone lines for your questions in a bit as well, so stick around.